From the Southeast Asian capital city of the Philippine Islands, the Philippine nation, Manila. Hi, everybody. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you may be in whatever time zone you're residing in. Every single one of them covered by this amazing program called Coast to Coast AM. I'm Art Bell. It is a pleasure and honor to be escorting you through the balance of the weekend. Sure was fun being here for Open Lines last night. And toward that end, by the way, if you would like to begin lining up for Open Lines right now, that's what we're going to have this hour. So feel free, if you have your appropriate number jotted down, to call it and begin lining up, and we'll probably get you on the air this hour. Let us take a quick look at the normally and never-to-be-disappointing, depressing news. President Bush hails troops as Iraq War is reviewed. President Bush marked Veterans Day by praising U.S. troops who have fought oppression around the world, yet spoke only briefly about Iraq, where U.S. commanders are reevaluating strategy. Speaking 3 days after announcing the ouster of Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, Bush hailed members of the armed services, past, present, and future, for their dedication and bravery. So basically, that's pretty good, I guess, as far as world news goes, until you get to the second story. In Iraq, Sunni gunmen ambushed a convoy of minibuses Saturday night at, get this, a fake checkpoint. That's a way to do it, a fake checkpoint on the dangerous highway south of Baghdad. It resulted in the killing of 10 Shiite passengers and the kidnapping of about 50 across the country. At least 52 other people were killed in violence or were found dead, five of those decapitated. Iraqi soldiers decapitated, boy. Police said the mass kidnappings and the killing was near the volatile town of Latifa, about 20 miles south of Baghdad in the so-called Triangle of Death. So I don't know how you rack it up here, but no matter how you look at it, it seems as though the news out of Iraq just gets worse and worse. Democrats now look to sustain majority. It's the question Democrats would rather not ask in their moment of celebration. Are their new majorities in the House and Senate sustainable? What if the war in Iraq is over by 2008? Or what if it is still being waged despite Democratic pledges to change the course? What if voter apathy toward President Bush is irrelevant in 2 years? After all, he will be on his way out. Tough questions, I guess, for the Democrats. Guess who's back in power in Nicaragua? Daniel Ortega. Huh. Daniel Ortega returns to Nicaragua's presidency, a shadow of the fiery revolutionary who in Cold War times vowed an endless fight against the U.S. government, determined to overthrow him. Balding, now weakened by heart trouble and often appearing almost docile, he now preaches reconciliation, stability, promises to maintain close ties with the U.S., as well as the veterans of the Contra Army that it trained and armed against him. Well, once burned, twice shy, I guess, in his case. LaShawn Harris took her three children on a train from Oakland. This is one of those stories that causes you not to want to read the world news. She took her three children on a train from Oakland into San Francisco October 19th, 2005. She bought the little boys hot dogs. They walked along Fisherman's Wharf. Then Harris undressed the three boys, ages 16 months, 2 and 6, and proceeded to drop them one at a time over the low railing into the chilly San Francisco Bay. Police say she knew they couldn't swim. She thought she was sending them to heaven. God had commanded her to sacrifice her three boys, she said, her most precious possessions. Harris later told psychiatrists, passerbys at the time, who actually saw all this, said she seemed dazed, in fact, disoriented. The United Nations vetoed a UN Security Council draft resolution Saturday that sought to condemn an Israeli military offensive in the Gaza Strip and demand Israeli troops pull out of the territory. U.S. Ambassador John Bolton said the Arab-backed draft resolution was biased against Israel and politically motivated. But of course, the death threat came on a simple white flyer, many of them blowing down the streets at dawn. A group calling itself Friends of Mohammed accused a local Palestinian Christian of selling mobile phones carrying offensive sketches of the Muslim prophet. The message went on to curse all Arab Christians and the Pope, still struggling to calm Muslim outrage over his remarks about Islam. For $5, not much, residents of one of the city's hardest hit neighborhoods received three tennis balls Saturday and then a chance to vent 15 months of frustration at the slow pace of rebuilding since Hurricane Katrina. The object of their annoyance sat perched atop a dunk tank. Bob Josephson, director of intergovernmental affairs in Louisiana for the reviled and much lampooned federal emergency management agency's handling of what occurred in Louisiana. So you got to give him credit, I guess, for that. He sat in a chair, sold them on the cheap a few baseballs or whatever that could be thrown and that would end up dunking him in the water. I bet they had a blast. We'll look at some of the rest of the news in a moment. By the way, at the top of the hour, this is going to be, I think, a very interesting show. We're going to take a little side trip here, and we're going to be interviewing a man who has written a book about, well, his name is Robert Young Pelton, and he's written a number of books about the world's most dangerous places and his adventures. And it's kind of interesting because I live in one of the world's most dangerous places. It's probably somewhere down the list, not toward the top of the list, but it is to be discussed as I look at the list of questions. So there you have it. We'll see how dangerous it is where I live. British and American scientists. Now, I know I have a lot of blind listeners who cannot see. British and American scientists have restored vision in blind mice by transplanting light-sensitive cells into their eyes in a breakthrough that could lead to new treatments of human eye disease. The mice suffered from eye damage called photoreceptor loss. Now, that occurs in macular degeneration, the leading cause of sight loss in the elderly and other eye disorders. But instead of using stem cells, which could form into any eye cell, the scientists this time transplanted cells that had reached a latter stage of development toward becoming photoreceptor cells. We have shown for the first time that it is possible to transplant photoreceptors, according to Dr. Robert McLaren, a scientist and eye surgeon at Moorfields Eye Hospital in London. These cells are lost in some of the more common causes of blindness, so a lot of you out there should be sitting straight up at this one. The scientists believe further research could lead to the first human retinal cell transplants for people with blinding diseases within a decade. It's always too far away, isn't it? Everybody's looking for instant cures. It's always too far. Now, here's a story that should rock back any environmentalist. It really should rock you back. It's from the BBC News, and the headline is Only 50 Years Left for sea fish. Environmental correspondent, BBC News website. There will be virtually nothing left to fish from the seas by the middle of the century if the current trends continue, according to a major scientific study. Stocks have collapsed in nearly a third of sea fisheries, and the rate of decline is now accelerating. Writing in the journal Science, the very well-respected journal Science, the international team of researchers says fishery decline is closely tied to a broader loss of marine biodiversity, but a greater use of protected areas could safeguard existing stocks if we do something. The way we use the oceans is that we hope and we assume there will always be another species to exploit after we've completely gone through the last one, right? What we're highlighting is that there is a finite number of stocks. We've gone through about a third of them now, and we're going to get through the rest. So they're saying in 50 years, folks, no more fish. Think about that a little bit. In 50 years, no more fish. Now, maybe perhaps a number of you will not be around in 50 years. I'm certainly in that group. And so you might say, well, who cares? But for your children and their children and the world as it, we all hope it goes on, you would want to be able to tap the ocean for food. And if you can't, I'm not exactly sure how mankind could continue. So there's a flash for you. 50 years, trend continues, no more fish. No more fish. Let's go to the lines. First time caller line, Richard in New York, you are on the air. Hello.
Hey, Art, a couple of things. First of all, with the that scares the hell out of me. I'm in your category. I'm not going to be around. Well, I don't know. Hopefully I'll be around. But, you know, if the fish are gone, that would mean the oceans are kind of dead, right?
Kind of dead, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think there's a largest proportion of the oxygen replenishment for the planet comes from algae from the surface of the ocean.
Right.
I don't know whether most people know that. It's not the trees. Everybody thinks,
no,
you know,
it's the algae.
Right. And if the fish are gone, then it's safe to assume the algae are gone. If the algae are gone, then the oxygen's gone. We're all in big trouble. At any rate.
That's exactly correct. The whole thing is just a disastrous mess, buddy. And I, in another 50 years, it's going to be like living on a different planet.
Oh, yeah. And there's a question I wanted to ask you, but before I do, very quickly, are you still struggling with changing centigrade to Fahrenheit and Fahrenheit to centigrade?
Not really. I mean, you know, you can put centigrade or Fahrenheit into Google, and you'll get a real quick conversion chart.
Did anybody ever tell you about the add 40, subtract 40 method?
They did.
Okay, so you know about that. Anyway, what I wanted to ask you is last night I was listening to your Open Line show, and I had to go to sleep because I had to get up early this morning, but you made a comment, and I said, surely I couldn't have understood this right, something about to the effect that us pulling out of Vietnam traumatized most of Americans, or something like that. Do you remember?
Yes, I said that, yes. Uh-huh. Our losing the war, what I really said was our losing the war in Vietnam, and it's widely, I think, accepted that we lost the war in Vietnam, was a trauma for Americans, yes. America had never lost a war, sir.
Yeah, but, you know, the trauma for Americans was being there in the first place. I mean, it put father against son.
Every war is a trauma.
What's that?
Every war is a trauma.
Yeah, but that really put a wedge in this country. Like, I can't remember anything like that.
Oh, I was there. I know about the wedge. I know all about it. We could have won that war.
No,
we could
We'd
have won
still be fighting
war.
It today with that kind of an
no.
attitude.
No, that's not true.
How
we had
won?
No, we had the power and not the will to win that war, sir.
When you look at where the enemy was coming from, mm-hmm. It wasn't just the North Vietnam, it was China. It was like we would have had to defeat practically most of the communists to win that war. It just wasn't going to happen. It wasn't going to happen. It was
well. You and I can't. I guess can't.
No, it was a.
You know, we can't refight the war. But the fact of the matter is, what I said was accurate. That we were traumatized by losing that war, and I don't think you can be in denial about that. I don't deny that the war itself was a horrible trauma. So I'm with you on that. But we did suffer a trauma by losing.
Well, I don't know. I think pulling out was the right thing to do when we did it. Probably a little bit too late if we pulled out a little bit earlier.
I agree with you on one ground, and that is if we were not willing to win it, then continuing to throw American young bodies into something that was just a half-assed attempt to win, we were better off pulling out. You're right.
Yeah, that's where I'm coming from. I mean,
you're coming from the right place. You're right.
I mean, the body bags came back like this is nothing. What's going on?
Man, right? I hear you. Oh, I know.
You know.
Don't say it's nothing. There's a lot of relatives of dead soldiers listening tonight. It's not nothing. When Americans are dying, it's something.
I mean, I saw what happened, Art. I was drafted in during the Tet Offensive in the infantry in the army.
Yeah, I joined instead.
People to this day ask me sometimes to talk. I don't want to talk about it.
I
don't want to talk about it. There's nothing really nice I can say about the whole thing.
I know.
You know, and it's
I know.
I know. War is a horrible situation.
Okay, sir, you're kind of proving my point. There's nothing good you can say about it. And I don't know what good you can ever say about any war. Maybe, you know, save perhaps the Second World War where we stopped somebody trying to take over the world.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that there's anything good you can say about Vietnam, and I don't know that there's really anything good you can say about Iraq either. The only difference can be the way we end it.
Yeah, well, I will grant you this, that it was traumatic seeing, you know, the last of the troops being taken off the roof of the embassy, you know.
Sure was.
I can still remember that, you know, when we finally pulled out. And the other people yelling, take me, take... That was a sad thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that was traumatic, very traumatic. But
all right,
the war...
thank you very much for the call. Look, the whole thing was traumatic, as you point out, and I concede that. The war itself, of course, was traumatic. But the loss and the fact that we lost really didn't sink in with the American people for a number of years. And when it did, it was very traumatic. And there was no relief of that until basically we won the first Iraq war. It was quick, clean, and we were out. Of course, now we're back. But for a short time after that first victory, it's as though the veil of failure from Vietnam had been lifted. Now we're in Iraq, and all that's left at this point is how we end it. And again, I say in Vietnam, we could have won. We had the power to win. We just weren't willing to use it. And the tragedy of it is that we were willing to continue to throw young American bodies into a half-assed effort to win, to end up with something less than a loss, which, of course, as he pointed out, we did not. Wildcard Line, David in San Diego, you're on the air.
Hi, Art.
Hi.
Hey, I got a solution for the... recently, the astronomers have been... They postulated they found planetary systems around other stars.
Yes.
And what that is, though, a couple of weeks ago, they had a guy on the show that postulated that the sun has calved off planets in pairs, and that's what's created Uranus, Neptune pair, Saturn, Jupiter pair, you know, Mars and Earth and Venus. So, but anyways, what we're seeing on those new systems that we're signing, they were saying that they were finding these huge planets super close in. Well, what we're seeing is the formation of planetary systems.
Maybe.
These are the Jupiter and Saturn planets popping
off. I mean, we're seeing these big planets, sir, because they're passing in front of the aforementioned stars. And so we're able now, with the very best telescopes, to see the sort of darkness or the little dark spot that's passing in front of these stars.
Yeah,
that's
we're
how
seeing,
we're locating them.
But we're seeing the formation of planetary systems, as in our Jupiter and Saturn being cast off.
Oh, that's
off.
A theory.
Yeah. And also, the reason we don't win wars anymore is the Caesar syndrome, is because after World War II, so many military commanders came home and became politicians and won everything, that the civilians, well, they said, well, we can't have these heroes coming home and taking our positions, so they make damn sure nobody wins wars anymore.
I never considered it.
I never considered
it from that point of view. Well, it's certainly true, isn't it? I like Ike. Well, where did Ike come from? He came from the Second World War, a hero of the Second World War, and sailed right into the presidency. So I'm not giving his argument specific weight, but he's certainly right about the heroes becoming politicians. West of the Rockies, you're on the air. Hi. Hello?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
Oh. Well, hello, Mr. Bell.
Hello.
My name is John. I live in Oregon.
Yes, John. Not a lot of time to the bottom of the hour here, so let it rip.
Well, I have a ghost story for you. Two winters ago, I was working graveyard at a gas station, and I was living with my uncle at the time, and I get a call about 1 in the morning, and he was like, is there someone in your room? And I said, no, and he said it sounded like someone was thrashing it apart. He didn't have a key, so he wasn't able to get in the room. So I can hear him shouting and, you know, hey, who's in there? And I was totally alone at the gas station, totally freaking out. And he hung up and called the cops, and they busted in there. And there was
very quickly, the music is under us.
Well, that's basically the story.
Okay. So it turned out to be nada, nothing?
Nothing, but it sounded like someone was totally tearing it apart.
Well, that is weird. Okay. Again, I don't want to turn this into Ghost to Ghost. I like to reserve the ghost stories for Ghost to Ghost AM, which is a yearly event. Maybe we'll extend it next year into a couple of days. People always have leftover ghost stories. There's no question about it. So maybe next year we'll move it to a couple of days. There are that many stories out there, after all. All right, folks, we'll take a break, and then more open lines on the way. So if you know the numbers, dial now, because after the break, they'll recite them very carefully, and the lines will be very full. I'm Art Bell. Here I am. I thought it was kind of funny. During the break, they run promos for the newsletter and, you know, that sort of thing. That's what I hear on this end as you're hearing commercials or whatever. And one of them was, did the CIA really send people to live on other planets? First time I've heard that one. Can you imagine that? We have the ability to send somebody to another planet. Of course, it's a one-way ticket. You go, but you don't come back. It would be light years in the doing, perhaps even generations. So can you imagine that? Packing up, sort of joining in with the CIA, and getting launched to another planet light years away. You will not come back. You will not know what you're going to get on the other end, what kind of planet, habitable or not, you're going to run into. And can you imagine getting picked for, volunteering for, or worse yet, getting drafted for a mission to another planet? I will have to read that story. More open lines in a moment. Actually, I'm going to be very interested to see what our guest at the top of the hour has to say about where I live, about here in the Philippines. But he's an expert in the most dangerous places in the world. I guess he's been to most of them and is quite an adventurer. And I'm looking forward to this interview. It should be very, very interesting. Let's go to one of the wild card lines and say, Ivan in Houston, you're on the air.
Hi. Sorry about that. I wasn't sure about your opinion. If we won or lost the war in Vietnam, what do you think?
We lost it.
We lost it, yeah. It makes me mad to hear people say that we never lost the war, because I think that it makes me think they're hypocrites of what they say. But
run that by me again, please.
I think they're hypocrites of what they say. But when they say that, go ahead.
When they say what? That we lost and have never lost a war?
Yeah. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
They're just playing wrong. They're just wrong.
Yeah, they are. I mean, you could clearly see the transformation from the movie Green Berets to scenes from Forrest Gump and other movies like that. And, I mean, I'm 17, and I've clearly, I want to be a history major. But, yeah, it just makes me mad of the thought of people saying we haven't lost the war.
Well, that's just ignorant. We clearly lost the war. You're only 17, huh? Well, enjoy history, and you're going to learn a great deal. I wonder, you know, the whole subject of history is in itself a fascinating topic. As a general rule, the victors in a war, and we are a warrior culture, we are a warrior people, the victors write the history. Now, had, for example, the Nazis won the war, the history of the whole thing would be completely different. The victors inevitably get the honor of writing the history. And so if they want to bend it and shape it a little bit and make it sound much better for the victorious side, that's their option. They won. East of the Rockies, Greg in Ohio, you're on the air.
Hey, it's Greg from Cincinnati. How you doing, Art?
Good.
Good afternoon. Listen, about 10 years ago, I was on the road, and I turned on the radio, and I caught you right in the middle of what you were saying. You said that you had gotten a jolt of electricity that was so powerful that your jaw locked open for a half an hour.
That's correct.
And I want to know, what in the world were you working on?
I was working on the first amplifier that I ever had, and radio amateur amplifier. It was for the hams out there, a pair of 813s, and they'll know what those are, and some of the older hams will anyway. And it was on an open chassis. You know, it wasn't closed. Uh-huh. And I was working away on it, and I came into contact with the plate. The top of the tube had plate, and I came in contact with that and the chassis, and that put 2,500 volts at, I can't recall, but it was, I don't know, a couple of amps at least, maybe an amp and a half through my body, and that should have been enough to kill me, but luckily, it
That's
threw me all the way across the room, plastered me up against the wall like in a cartoon, locked my jaw open, and I couldn't move for a long time. And then, it, as I mentioned back then, and now I say again now, it took about 30 minutes to get my jaw unlocked.
It should have killed you then.
Yeah, it should have killed me.
Wow. Hey, how's your personal safety? Has that improved over there?
With, my personal safety...
Article?
Well, that's a different story.
Yeah.
That's always a problem, but... But I live in a relatively safe place, or
well,
at least
good.
I think I do, until I get my guest at the top of the hour, and he'll probably tell me something else.
All right, you take care, Art.
All right, you take care too, sir, and thank you very, very much for the call. Let's go west of the Rockies and say you're on the air all the way from Fairbanks, Alaska. Chuck.
Yes, Art, how you doing? I've talked to you in the past. I was wondering, do you believe in curses? And I have a reason for asking that question, but do you believe in them?
I think to some degree I do.
Yeah. Well, I was in a remote Eskimo village, and you posted my picture on your website years ago with some mammoth tusks, and I buy tusks and stuff from the...
I remember you.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, this village, and I was talking to a lady, and it used to be a wonderful village, and everybody hunted and got along, and I said, what happened, you know, because people are on drugs, and they're not hunting anymore. And she called it the Curse of the Iputec, where in... their yard, they dug up an ancient burial of this really strange culture that's kind of seemed like it came from another planet or something. But they had elaborate, death masks and all kinds of stuff, where most of the Eskimos used to put their dead out on the ice, and this culture didn't. But she said ever since then that all these weird things had happened. The village was fighting with each other, and nobody's hunting. And it was an interesting story. I just was curious if you... I heard something.
No, I had never heard this particular story, Chuck, but I would like to ask you a sort of a broader question.
Sure.
About, the natives in Alaska now. I mean, there are hard times. As you know, the climate is changing for them. That's difficult. They've always had a problem with alcohol. And now you're telling me some of them with drugs. And are things not going well for the natives?
It's a time of great change, and I get to travel more than most. And most people, you lived here at one time, you realize how little of the state you can see on the road system.
Oh, and that's for sure.
And I take trips, and we've got just a fascinating culture and just wonderful people. We have almost 300 villages, and most of them at one time were 80% subsistence. And they moved around a lot. When they built the schools in the 50s, they all settled in, and they required more government help, and there's all different degrees of problems, but I trace it all back to the demoralizing effects of socialism, where you give people something and help them out, and they don't have to do anything for it. And
it just never works. It never,
never
ever works, and
no. It's
even worse. The givers, whoever they are inevitably hated eventually for their act.
Exactly. And, it was funny because when I flew out of this village, I was on this small plane. I was talking to a gentleman, and I was saying, what happened? And I said, I think it was socialism. And he said, well, we've always had socialism because the people really take care of the elders, and they really – and I said, but not this kind of socialism where people – give people something for nothing. And I found out that he was like the leader in the area, and he agreed with me. He said, yeah, you got a point. He said that But there are just some incredible people. You want to talk a little bit about climate change. One of my favorite villages is just in the middle of nowhere, and they've collected fossils for me for 20 years. And they still gather over 80% of their food, you know, and they speak the language, the Yupik language.
Sure.
But their village is washing away. It's actually, they're in the process of moving it. And I don't, you know, a lot of it they used to build in places that probably aren't, you know, what we'd consider suitable. But there is, I get to see a lot more than most people, and there is definite warming and climate change. Some of it I kind of welcome. I mean, let's see, what is it here right now? It's 9 below.
It's 9 below.
Yeah.
Well, I know, but to see areas where there was virtual permanent ice turning into virtual permanent ocean, in fact, ocean that can be navigated by ships, is pretty scary. I mean, I don't think we're supposed to see these kinds of changes in one lifetime.
Well, I don't know. You know, I kind of deal in fossils and stuff, and we find things that, you know, there were dinosaurs here. There's been climate changes. I think that we probably have, and I kind of look at it from a biblical perspective that man has gone about things in the wrong way, and it says in the Bible that the earth will even suffer for it, and I think that's what's happening.
But, yeah, you could be right. I envy you being up there. Fairbanks is, it's kind of like one of the last frontiers. Is that fair to say?
It's an incredible place. It's one of the few places where in Alaska you can carry a concealed gun without a permit. You can, you know, we don't lock our doors. There's crime here and stuff if you're in the wrong areas. But I can be at a wildlife reserve in 5 minutes or out hunting or doing things. But it's just like anywhere. You have to work hard, and I really don't get out to enjoy it as much as I would like to. But I hitchhiked up here as a young man when I was 17 in 1971 from Arizona. I fell in love with it, and I've made my home here as an artist. And there are a lot of opportunities. If you can't make it here, I think you should just shoot yourself. I mean, there's always something for somebody to do if you don't mind working and you like the outdoors. And the winters are just incredible because the seasons are changing every day. You know, we're losing
daylight.
They are
cold. It is cold in Fairbanks, Chuck.
Yep. All right. Well, good talking with you there where it's warm, and maybe I'll come visit you someday.
Warm is putting it mildly. Okay, thank you. Yeah, I recall the years that I spent in Anchorage, Alaska. Now, for about 2 weeks in Anchorage, inevitably, the thermometer would plunge to, between 40 and 50 degrees below zero, and it would come sweeping in, and that's really cold, folks. I mean, that's really cold. And so the only way I was able to live there was I plugged in everything. I heated everything. I plugged my car in. That would heat the oil pan. It would heat the interior of the car so that when snow hit it, it would melt. You would heat the radiator. That would be, in other words, wherever you would go, you would plug your car in. And if you didn't, the expectation for it starting would be very low indeed. It was a pretty wild time, but I spent 3 years there, and so I definitely know what it's like. Let's go to, I don't know, how about New York and Sean?
Hi, Art. I remember a few years ago you voicing your concerns about the proposal to turn Yucca Mountain into a radioactive waste depository.
That's correct.
I wonder if you've heard about a new bit of technology that's being developed in Italy, I believe it is, where they're taking radioactive waste and they've encapsulated it inside of molten copper. And by doing so, they've accelerated the rate at which the radioactive waste decays.
By how much?
I believe at this point in time, the technology being in its infancy, they have managed to accelerate it by something like 5 times. But they hope to, you know, as they develop the technology, they hope to accelerate it by a great deal, by very much, you know. I heard the story on the BBC, and, you know, perhaps if you went to their website, you might dig up the story.
See what I can do. That's a really interesting story. There was also several years ago, I saw a Good Morning America episode in which they had this machine that would take the worst of it, plutonium,
right,
and was that they were able to virtually make it almost harmless in this machine. I can't recall any more facts about it. It was a long time ago.
Wow.
But there are several schemes out there like this, and we still seem bent, I guess, on going ahead and putting it in Yucca Mountain, which, by the way, has earthquake faults.
Right. That's not too good. I wonder too, secondarily, if they encapsulate this radioactive waste inside a lump of molten copper. What if they were to, let's say, not just encapsulate it inside a lump, but inside a casting, you know, such that at the end of the period of radioactive decay, that particular casting will become some sort of new alloy.
Sean, I have absolutely no idea. There's no way I could have any idea because I don't understand the theory behind encapsulating in molten copper in the first place. I don't understand how copper acts upon radioactivity to accelerate its decay process in the first place. So to answer anything further would be totally impossible. But that's fascinating, and I'll see what I can find out about it. East of the Rockies, Mary Kay in New York City.
Oh, hi, Art. How are you doing tonight?
Just fine.
Good. I just wanted to kind of talk about the concept that people are always talking about winning wars.
Yes.
Especially from the point when you think of when you have international bankers who are arming both sides. You know, we talk about World War II being such a noble war. And, you know, we had Standard Oil selling oil to Germany and such. And it just kind of, you know.
Yeah, but it was a noble war compared to what we've had since.
Oh, yeah, compared to the. But it just seems like most wars are started chaos, you know, and usually as a smokescreen for something else. So it just kind of astounds me when I keep
and this one
about
probably
winning wars. And
this war probably fits in that category, huh? In other words, the weapons of mass destruction, despite the emails I'll get, we're not there. And we have perhaps reasonable objectives in going into Iraq. I think they are reasonable. We need some sort of base situation there. I think we could stabilize the Middle East ultimately if we have bases there. I think we could prevent Iran from spreading what otherwise it's going to spread. And of course the oil. There are a lot of reasons for being there, none of which we stated.
Yeah, well, if those were really the reasons why the powers that be were initiating things like this, because when you just see the all the ineptitude, and these are not stupid people, these generals and whatever. They're not stupid people. I think if they wanted to win something, if the government wanted to win, the resources would be there and something positive would be happening. It just seems like when you have chaos on top of chaos, that seems to be what the goal they want. They want chaos.
Well, I could not agree with you more, and that's what we have at the moment there is chaos. So there were probably solid reasons for having this war, but they were reasons that we could not state. Traditionally, the United States has only gone to war when somebody has hit us, right? Well, you can't really make the case that 9/11 was a reason to go into Iraq. Even the president has not tried to make that case. So that wasn't it. Nobody really shot at us from Iraq. So why did we begin the war with Iraq? The second war is what I'm now referring to. And I think all the reasons I just talked about, strategic reasons, having bases there, and no doubt the oil and just the geographic influence that we can have, all of these are good, solid reasons for being there. Now, the only real reason that we stated was what a bad guy Saddam Hussein was. But, that's not enough of a reason. My God, if that was enough of a reason, then we'd be to war with Somalia, because that's run by warlords. We'd have been to war when the slaughter was going on in Cambodia, because that was ever so much worse than anything Saddam ever did, even with the gassing of the Kurds. What went on in Cambodia was much more deserving of U.S. intervention if we're going to intervene in a country because of the wrongdoings internally in that country. If that's a reason, then there are many, many, many countries that would have justified the U.S. going in and stopping whatever was going on, or perhaps Angola, where beheadings would make the number of beheadings in Iraq look like nothing. So that was the best reason we could publicly come up with, and it wasn't much of a reason at all. But now that we're there, I am a person who says we ought to go ahead and finish the job. From Manila in the Philippines, I'm Art Bell.